Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I am chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is with Bill Bagley, and we're very excited to have him here. And I would like to welcome any new members to the club who are here tonight. And please, if you are new or you're listening at our listening with our radio audience, please check out our programs in the club magazine or at the club website at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now with that, I would like to introduce Bill Bagley. I'm just going to read you his biography. William T. Bagley is a retired senior partner of the nationwide law firm Nossaman LLP based in the San Francisco office. Mr. Bagley served as a member of the University of California Board of Regents 1989 to 2002 and was named Alumnus of the Year 2002 by the California Alumni Association. He served as a trustee of the Marin Community Foundation, the $1 billion Buck Trust. He was Governor Duke Machen's first appointee to the California Public Utilities Commission, 83 to 86, and to the California Transportation Commission, 83 to 89, and is past chairman of the CTC. Mr. Bagley served in the legislature representing Marin and Sonoma counties, 1961 to 1974, successfully authoring more than 500 pieces of civil law legislation. He also served in Washington, D.C., appointed by President Ford as the first chairman of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, 75 to 79. Mr. Bagley graduated Phi Beta Kappa, permanent class president and valedictorian of the University of California at Berkeley, class of 49, and is a 1952 graduate of Berkeley's Bolt Hall School of Law, where he served on the board of editors of the California Law Review.
Bill was going downhill ever since.
Bill was born June 29, 1928, in San Francisco, California. He's married to the former Diane Oldham and is the father of five children. The family resides in San Francisco, California.
San Rafael.
Oh, I'm sorry. I stand corrected.
When I moved, we raised the level of intelligence of both areas.
The family resides in San Rafael, California. With that, Bill Bagley.
Thank you so much. And beyond Bill Bagley, this is not about Bill Bagley. This is about the state of California. When you look at the book, you'll see some fond remembrances, but this is really about the state and looking around this wonderful room and thanking the Commonwealth Club. I really thank you for caring. You wouldn't be here otherwise. So you care about the state, which gives me just a little bit of heart, because what you're going to hear is not going to be my normal optimism. It's going to be a little bit of a sad story. First of all, let me add to the introduction, you good people should know, have a frame of reference. You're listening to this guy, you hardly know him, some of you do. Why the hell is he here? What's he talking about? Why is he doing this? Well, give you a frame of reference politically. I characterize myself as an evangelical moderate. Now think about that. I'm really a former liberal Republican who is now a declined estate voter. And we'll get into that and the reasons for it. But I wanted you to know I'm not here to sell anything. I'm not here to sell books. Buy the book. The Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California gets all the proceeds. I'm not a book salesman. I did sit down and write the book. So I wanted to give you that little background so you know who I was. Just one little tiny sentence of bragging. I beat Willie Brown on the NAACP voting record one year as a Republican in 1971. And that's relevant, because that's the way we used to be, my friends. Now, I have to add, as a real tangent from everything else, one of my Republican colleagues said to me, Bill, when I was voting for fair housing in 1963 from Marin County and Sonoma, why are you doing that? You don't have any of them. What a terrible comment. Now, I give you that as an example that all legislators were not as pristine as I make them out in this wonderful book about bipartisanship. Out of 120 legislators, there were probably anywhere between 10 and 20 who were dolts, crooks, and cheap drunks. That's about the average of the American populace. And then there were another 40 or 50 just decent, common, good people, and another 20 or 30 wonderful human beings who made the system work. There are no more of those today for a couple of reasons, and we'll get to it. I won't ask you for a show of hands unless some of you'd like to show your hands. How many of you here think favorably about term limits? Oh, we've got it. Oh, yeah, look at those nice people. Hang your head in shame, my friends. Hang your head in shame. We'll get to that and we'll reasons why in a moment. So I have now introduced myself. It is the book, A Living History of the State. It was written primarily to help saving the state. Somebody has to. Incidentally, anybody who tries to buy the governorship for $150 million should not be allowed to do so. And I hope all of you know what I'm talking about. And if you don't, you will soon when you listen to the ads. One of the problems is the growth of ideology, and we'll talk about that. So beware. Beware of initiatives, and beware of ideologues. In that golden years, and we'll get into the book right now, until 1978, we had no aisles. You know what aisles are? The Republicans sit there, the Democrats sit there, and never the twain shall meet. There were no aisles. Those of you who are a little bit beyond early life will know the name Al Alquist, wonderful Democratic assemblyman and then senator from San Jose. He was my seatmate till he died at the age of 90. He called me seatmate. We became friends. And the aisles were caused by the so-called, we're going to talk a little lingo here, the so-called Prop 13 babies. They were elected along with Howard Jarvis's Prop 13. And they came to Sacramento, not to govern, but to abdicate. And the first thing they wanted to do is sit together as Republicans. That's one of the problems we're going to discuss. The difference, and this is sort of vital for the whole concept. You have term limits in city councils and boards of supervisors, 8 years. But in each instance of counties and cities, there is a commonality. People come from the same constituency. They know city government. They know county government. They've lived there long enough to get elected. That's absolutely contrary to what happens in the legislature. If you're from Siskiyou or San Diego or Mono or Monterey, you were elected by your own constituents and don't know any one of the 119 other people unless you served on the staff. So you come to Sacramento totally disparate from everybody else. And I'll jump ahead. Do you see the reason the term limits has caused what we are experiencing today? That passed in 1990. Is a 6-year term limit. You are elected this November. In 4 years, 2/3 of your colleagues will be gone. 2/3 of your colleagues are gone. In the next 2 years, you're a lame duck looking for something else to do. You have absolutely no commonality with anybody else there. And you've only got 4 years to learn a little bit about them. Remember the 10 or 20 who are cheap crooks and drunks? You don't even know who they are, because it takes you 3 or 4 years to find out. Everything I'm telling you, I lived through. This is living history, my friend. So start in with the decline and now almost the default of government in the state. It started in, let's go back, Hiram Johnson, 1911, 1912, was trying to do away with power politics and party power. So he instituted cross-filing. Those of you who were around knew that up until 1959, in the primary, You, as a Republican, could file in the Democratic primary. You, as a Democrat, could file in the Democratic, in the Republican primary. And that broadened the spectrum because the appeal was across the board. The League of Women Voters, the Democratic Party in 1959 when Pat Brown took over. 58 was when Bill Nolan destroyed the state by running for governor and lost by a million votes to Pat Brown. But the Democrats immediately said, we want party responsibility. So they repealed cross-filing. No more cross-filing. Make the party stand up to its principles. That's what's happening today, my friends. So 1974, reform, beware of reform, my friends. Proposition 9, political reform. Those people in Sacramento are being wined and dined by lobbyists. Read the book. My friend, and he is my friend, Jerry Brown, in order to run for governor, sponsored an initiative to make sure that no lobbyist could spend more than $10 a month on any legislator or key staff. That absolutely did away with camaraderie and collegiality. Now, people can go to dinner if they want, but the lobbyists would supply lunches and dinners and little entertainment day after day, night after night. Within 6 months, I was elected in 60. In 6 months, by June of 61, I got to know 119 other members of the legislature. You know why? Because we had all of these events, and they were all bipartisan. What happened? The lobbyists continued, but now instead of a $20, and the big dinner was 15 or 20 bucks, you know, a big dinner is $30 or $40. But what happened? Instead of dollars, instead of dinners, we had dollars. Today, you could spend $100,000 a week if you were a lobbyist and went to every event, and the events cost you $3,900 per ticket. Not $15 for lunch or $20 for dinner, but $3,900 to meet a legislator. And you know, my friends, they don't put on bipartisan fundraisers. They're all partisan. So the members never see each other socially. They don't buy each other dinners. The lobbyists used to. That happens no more. No more civility, no more camaraderie. Evan Bayh just the other day resigned, basically. He said he wasn't running for the Senate anymore. He said, Washington has become toxic. People don't know each other anymore. I can't do anything about Washington, but we can do something about California. You don't demonize someone when you've had dinner with him. You don't demonize someone when you know his family or her family, or when you played cards all night long. We had a running card game every Monday night with the leadership of both parties, speakers and minority leaders. Ways and Means Committee used to meet on Tuesday. When Willie Brown became chairman of Ways and Means, he changed Ways and Means to Wednesday, so he could play cards on Monday night. You don't hurt each other if you are a friend and if you've learned to trust. It takes you 3 or 4 years, not only to learn where the men's room is and how to get along with the system, which is complicated, but it takes you 3 or 4 years to learn who you can trust, with whom you want to work, and then the next 4 or 5 years of tenure, you get something done. And if you read the book, you'll see some fantastic is Arnold's word, it's not my word, some fabulous things that we were able to do in the 60s and 70s because we worked together. Remember, there were no aisles. But when Proposition 13 came along, these boys demanded aisles. 1990, partly because it was a little bit of a racist move to get rid of Willie. He'd been the Ayatollah of Sacramento. He was outrageous. I told him once, take humility pills, Willie, please. But he did well. Term limits in part was aimed at him. And people voted for it. Get rid of those people up there. 6-year term. It feeds upon itself because today, the last nail in the coffin was the reapportionment of 2000, which literally the parties cooperated for one of the first times ever. They vested their own seats, so they couldn't lose. Yeah, 30-some-odd Republicans, nobody could lose. I think there's been one change of party in the last 10 years, or two, out of 120 seats times five elections. They vested their seats, so it's hard right and hard left. And now it feeds upon themselves. This gets a little bit, that's not complicated, it's the facts. It feeds upon itself because with term limits, you know when the next Senate seat is going to come up. It's going to come up in 2 years. And I'm in the Assembly and I can run for the Senate, but I got to get nominated. Now, hard left or hard right? So in the Assembly, even if you were a moderate, you vote hard right in order to get nominated for the Republican Senate seat in Orange County. Or you vote hard left in San Francisco to get nominated. That is what has happened. And now you have heard the litany to the state of California in the last 30 or 40 years. And it is sad. The caucuses. Now, a committee chair used to be assemblyman, they're now assembly members, but assemblymen and assemblywomen, when they become a chairman, they get some staff, committee staff, two or three people. We never had caucus staff. Republican caucus, Democratic caucus. Three or four caucus meetings a year, mostly on budget matters. Today, the caucus staff takes positions on every bill other than inconsequential resolutions. The caucus staff is 30 or 40 members of the independent staff of the caucus, having nothing to do with the members. 25-year-old kids write caucus reports. And they're given out before the committee meeting, excuse my voice, and before the floor votes. The members vote according to the 25-year-old caucus staff recommendation. By rote, my friends. You go to a committee, you'll see all the Republicans voting one way and all the Democrats voting the other. You go on the floor, you'll see 30-some-odd Republicans voting no and 40-some-odd Democrats voting aye. Constantly. Don't mean to yell at you. They vote by rote. They're not legislators. They're following the caucus position and the new members. The culture is such the new members think that's the way it is. So they fall right in line and they all vote according to the caucus position. It's not legislating. Incidentally, beware, my friends, anybody who tells you their voting record is 100% labor or 100% chamber of commerce or 100% environmental. They're not legislating. Following some damn rule somewhere given to them by somebody else. So the art of compromise is, it's not only unrecognized, unpracticed, it's derogated. You get castigated if you try to compromise in Sacramento. Now that's the bad news. And I've given it to you hard, but my friends have given it to you correctly. You know, reform has brought on these things, and you all voted for them, my friends. I've had an old political expression, I share it with you, vacuums attract. Politics and physics are very similar. Vacuums attract. A vacuum was created because nobody could take a legislator to lunch anymore. So what happened? Political action committees formed, and major fundraising events occurred every night. Hand raised. We never had a fundraiser in Sacramento until political reform passed. Because then the lobbyists would come around, give you $200 every 2 years, and you know that was their budget. You didn't have a fundraiser. Hal Broders of the Bank of America give you $200 every 2 years. You didn't have a fundraiser. You knew he was good for $200. Today, the night before the bank bill, everybody has a $3,900 event. That's what's happened to our government. I hate to say it, because of reform. But I've told you the story, and frankly, this is why we wrote the book. Just because no one else has displayed those facts, I do it fairly, I do it decently, I do it civilly, because we need some civility. The solutions. Happily, Oh, I didn't lift this up. I meant to do this to get your attention, but I've got your attention. This is July Barron's issue, front page. Dream on, it says, California. Be glad you're not here. We have a reputation, my friends, nationally, of being a failing state. Again, that's why we wrote the book, trying to get somebody's attention, to have somebody do something about it. Arnold Schwarzenegger tried, but you know, he was also an amateur like that lady that's spending $150 billion to become governor. And amateurs don't do that well. You need somebody that knows the process. Amateur legislators don't do that well. Put everything else aside, you've got to know who's there. You've got to know department heads. You've got to know who, with whom you're going to work. You've got to know who to trust in the administration. It takes you 3 or 4 years to learn who you're going to trust, and then you're a lame duck. So there are some solutions. It'll take a while. First of all, reapportionment, as I'm sure you know because you're all perceptive, educated people, you wouldn't be here otherwise. So I've complimented every one of you, even though you voted for term limits. Reapportionment will now be done by a citizens committee, and they're choosing the members now. That'll come up in 2012. It'll take 3 or 4 or 5 years through attrition to get rid of the ideologues, to get rid of the right-wingers, and get rid of the far left-wingers. The right-wingers, I didn't tell you this, take an oath. An oath is foisted upon them by a national group. And this happens every election. They take an oath, literal oath, not to raise revenue. Abdication, abject abdication in advance. Swallow those words and remember them. They take an oath not to raise taxes. I didn't come here to raise taxes, but with a $20 billion deficit. And 80% of a $100 billion budget ingrained in law. So you've only got about $20 billion of discretionary money. How in the devil are you going to cut $20 billion when there's only $20 or $25 billion of discretionary money in the whole damn budget? But oh no, take an oath never to raise revenue, never to raise taxes. That's what happens. So reapportionment will correct itself. The open primary on the ballot, to the eternal credit of Abel Maldonado, who compromised to pass last year's bad budget and got the Democrats to agree and the Republicans to put the open primary on the June ballot. That will be up for a vote. I was president, somebody drafted me 6 years ago for the last open primary we had. It got beaten by another bipartisan cooperation. Both parties got together and put a competing poison pill on the ballot and beat us. You will be voting on the open primary. When that passes, everybody will get one ballot. One ballot. You won't get a Democratic ballot or a Green ballot or a Republican ballot. You get one ballot with all of the names on the ballot. And if there are a few Republicans here from San Francisco, no sense in you nominating a Republican. You will vote for the more conservative Democrat. In Orange County, in some of the districts, 60% Republican. No sense in being a Democratic nominee or voting for some poor Democrat who's running only because he wants to be a member of the State Central Committee. That's why they run. You will vote for the more conservative, for the more liberal Republican. And after 4 or 6 years, after attrition sets in and we wash ourselves of the ideologues, you're going to have moderation because in the primary, my friends, your candidates will be appealing across the board and particularly across to the 20% or more of declined estate voters who are now basically eunuchs because they don't choose a ballot and they don't vote in the primaries. So that's solution number two. Solution number three. Please, somehow, and this is going to be difficult, do you think the public is going to vote to extend term limits to these people who have ruined governance in California? But if it were only 12 years instead of six, After 4 years, you learn your way around. The next 6 or 8 years, you actually begin to produce not only legislation that you've worked on. My partner, Jack Knox, was elected with me in 1960. Jack later became a partner in our law firm. Jack wrote CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, in 1970, with Speaker, Republican Speaker Bob Monaghan, as his co-author. Imagine a Republican and a Democrat co-authoring a major bill, and by God, Ronald Reagan signing it. Jack Knox wrote all kinds of major legislation. It's in the book. As a 20-year term Democrat, across the board, we all voted with him because he had good legislation, because he was there long enough, knew enough of how to get things done. You couldn't do any of that today. You concentrate on an issue, you got one or two bills, and the bills die, and the issue dies, and you go bye-bye. That's what's happened to California. It's a sad story, but I gave you the solutions. Reapportionment, open primary, and lastly, and this is more structural, bring home rule back to California. It was a motto of the League of California Cities, home rule, where local decisions were made locally. Home rule is now a homey homily. I don't know that some of you have heard the word in 20 years. It all went, by the way, because, my friends, of Prop 13. Prop 13 passed. Not only did it control property tax, and incidentally, I debated Howard Jarvis, KCBS, and other forums around San Francisco. Few of you recall that Howard Jarvis was president of the Los Angeles Taxpayers Association, an apartment house association. He was trying to reduce taxes on the apartment houses, not on your homes. And the guy was an absolute buffoon. He speaks well of me, but he was an absolute buffoon. But what happened is it concentrated all the power in Sacramento because local government had no more funds. We're starved. So Sacramento picked up education. Sacramento picked up the courthouse. Sacramento picked up welfare. Sacramento picked up everything. And local government still regulates the Planning Commission. So bring back local government, restructure the state, and do all those other nice little things that I talked about. And in 10 or 20 years from now, Sacramento will salivate out of prosperity, and California will come back to its four. That's all I've got to say right now. Thank you for caring. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Bill. We're going to open it up now for questions from the audience. I'm going to have to turn on the microphone for you. Yeah, right here.
Sir.
Mr. Bagley, I am a Republican. I've always thought that primary should be Democrat here and Republican here in order that liberal Democrats don't decide who the Republican candidate would be. So, but what you say, it makes very good sense because we now got extremes on both sides and we wonder why they can't come to any agreement in Sacramento. That's clear. So with that in mind, I ask you this question.
Sir.
Why have parties to begin with? What if they have no principles that set them apart from one another?
That's a good question. I don't think the founding fathers, in fact, you've all read, they didn't think parties were part of government. There's nothing about parties in the Constitution. Rather simplistic answer. It's a good question. The parties have a First Amendment right, obviously, to get together and pass resolutions and try to, in the nice sense of the word, foist their views and their principles upon the electorate. They still have that right, and they can still do that. But when they cause gridlock by, you see what's happened with the decline to state movement. When we were elected in 60, Marin and Sonoma, it's from Sausalito to Stewart's Point, from Corte Madera to Cloverdale, like Minden was saying in those days. The registration was 48% Republican, 48% Democratic, and 4% declined to state. It's 20-some-odd percent declined to state today. As the declined to state voters leave parties, the parties become more and more narrow. I didn't cover that. And when you get narrow parties, you get what I talked about. The parties still exist. They simply shouldn't, dictate to members from day one how to vote. Sorry, but that's my view, sir.
I'd like to ask you a question about taxes. I think you make a very good point that we have a $20 billion budget deficit and they can't raise taxes. So the only way they can even try to meet it, which is always ineffectual, is to cut health, education, and social services, whatever funding you can cut. So on the one hand, the Republicans may sign an oath to get nominated not to raise taxes. It's kind of a mantra of the Republicans. But the Democrats are terrified to raise taxes because they think it's going to cost them the chance to get elected. So, and I think a lot of people have been brainwashed that not only taxes are bad, but government is bad. I'm just wondering what you think would be a useful way to persuade people that taxes are necessary and it's a good thing to raise taxes in order to avoid the kind of situation we seem to have every year in California.
Well, it's not categorically a good thing, don't get me wrong, to raise taxes. But when you have a deficit that's unmanageable and literally unfathomable, as I've pointed out, somewhere along the line you have to be flexible enough. This is all I'm asking, is flexibility. Now, one way of correcting the problem in the longer run is to broaden the base. You know, retailers are massively discriminated against by the internet. There's no sales tax. And the more the internet takes over sales, the less tax base we're going to have. So obviously, broaden the base. Apply the sales tax, if you will, to services like lawyers. So there are ways of improving the situation. One more. Think about this. The fuel tax, the gasoline tax, is the only tax that's gone down almost exponentially in the last 30 years because it's a tax on miles per gallon. I used to get 13 miles to the gallon in my 1974 Mercury. I get 30 miles to the gallon in my nice new brand car, and it's a big car. So mileage has doubled, and therefore your gasoline tax has been cut in half. People don't know that, and they're not going to apply to raise the taxes. But there are some areas where you could raise revenue without hurting the economy, and it's needed today. That's my answer. Sir.
Hello. Another structural change element that's been in discussion recently in the state is adjusting the threshold requirement of 2/3 of the assembly members mm-hmm. and senators to pass mm-hmm. financial regulations or budgets or taxes.
Right.
Do you have any opinions on that in particular?
Oh, I have opinions if you ask me. I hope I'm not opinionated though. I hope so. I hope you know that. I'm pleading for flexibility. Pleading for civility also. Interestingly, it was in 1933 that the 2/3 requirement is the Riley Stewart Act. Remember, I was in the legislature a while and I used to know these things and still remember some of them. 1933, someone thought it was a great idea to have a 2/3 vote to pass the budget. So that's been the law all 14 years that I was in the legislature. And let me divert, and I'll get back to the question. We used to take a caucus position. Remember I told you once in a while we'd have a caucus meeting. And in those days, there were at least a dozen of the Republicans who were really good friends with Jess Unruh, and he was a masterful speaker, and he always had a few Republican votes in his pocket. Which you don't have today. Well, we had Republican chairmanships under Democratic speakers and Democratic chairmanships under Republican speakers. And when you get a close house. When you get a 3842 or a 3743 house, you have good government. You actually have real bipartisanship without selling out. But back to the question, all we did was we'd have a little caucus meeting, and Pat Brown's last budget was $4.6 billion. Incidentally, you'll see this in the book. Ronald Reagan, 4 years later, his budget was $10 billion. Ronald Reagan doubled the budget in 4 years. People don't know that. I negotiated a tax increase of $2 billion out of a $10 billion budget. Ronald Reagan happily said he'd reform taxes. But we would simply say, well, let's cut a couple of hundred million out of a $5 billion budget, and the Democrats would go along, and we'd all vote for the budget. It's the way it worked. Prop 13 came along and said not just the budget, but to raise revenue, brand new, from 1974, 1978 forward. It takes a two-thirds vote to raise taxes. You could decrease the threshold for passing a budget, but you'd still have Prop 13 staring you in the face. The decrease could be statutorily on the budget, but constitutionally, because of Prop 13, you're locked into a two-thirds vote for revenue. So it won't help a hell of a lot, although there's a public cry to do away with the two-thirds vote. You'd get a budget, but you couldn't get any revenue. So it's sort of a facade, the issue is. That's my answer. Yes, my friend.
Is there any chance of a constitutional convention?
Not right now, and this is just my reading knowledge. And the Bay, again, most of you know, the Bay Area Council sponsored a group. I was in Sacramento about 6 months ago. We had an all-day session. It was televised over the state channel. A lot of great people, about 300 or 400 people, convening for that purpose. Bay Area Council, as I read, has only raised about $100,000, and it takes a couple of million to get something on the ballot, and signature time is running out. So you're not going to have any movement this year. Parenthetically, and though this is a good one, signature gathering, Hiram Johnson, public participation initiative and referendum, signature gathering is a business now, and there are 3 or 4 major businesses. And if you tried to change the regulations on signature gathering, they come to Sacramento and lobby against the changes because it's their business. It's become a business. So ultimately, in order particularly to restructure and bring back home rule, you will need a constitutional convention. It's not going to happen this year. It's not going to happen next year. There are problems, and one of the problems is how do you limit the convention to governmental structure rather than abortion and gay marriage and the rest of the social issues that people want to pursue. That's my answer.
I have one. Bill, you...
Oh, no, I don't take questions from you. It's my former law partner, and I'm not going to allow him to talk to me. Come to the office, and I'll answer your question.
Well, I think everybody would like to hear the answer to
that. All right, I'll accede.
What do you think of... Jerry Brown, and how do you think he would do as governor?
That's a fair question. Remember, I started on from the days and after my graduation as a Republican. I was president of the Young Republicans, all those good things that you do when you're 25 years old. Got elected as a Republican. Traveled the state with Nelson Rockefeller in 1964, a wonderful human being. He was huggable, and we knew all these people. You hugged Rockefeller. You didn't hug Nixon, but you hugged Rockefeller. Well, it's true. It's all in the book. Jerry Brown was a irascible governor, and I blame him in part, as you heard, for the decline of camaraderie and civility. Jerry Brown has matured. Now, again, you'll see this in this little booklet that I wrote. Remember, every night was Saturday night in Sacramento. Tuesdays, one group had a luncheon. Mondays, one group had a luncheon. Tuesdays was the California Derby Club. Wednesdays was another group. Thursdays was, somebody called us, and God knows where the word came from, moose milk. Forget the word. It was an open house where everybody allowed, constitutional officers, legislators, 100 people at a penthouse in a hotel, every Thursday, all getting together for lunch. Thursday was usually the last day of the session, so people on their way home all came to this lunch. Remember, we all knew each other. 6 months ago, I talking to Jerry, and he said, Bill, we ought to bring back moose milk. I reminded him that he outlawed it. And Jerry has matured. If you read, and you all do, you saw an article in yesterday's paper that the Jerry will take the middle road, he'll run through the middle, and that's where you win, and he will oppose, we are sure, this lady from eBay who says we need business to come in and run government. She's only voted a half a dozen times in her life. To my knowledge, yet she's never been to Sacramento, has no idea of how it all works. Jerry Brown has matured. Jerry Brown will at least give you the comfort of having somebody there who knows how it works and hopefully will help make it work. As I told you, I think, in the beginning, I am now a declined estate voter, and I will, we'll announce it, but we don't want anybody to know yet because we'd like to make a public statement sometime in late fall. I will probably vote for Jerry Brown. Question.
Yes, I have a number of friends who are public school teachers and other friends that are still involved in the public
yes.
education program.
My commiserations to you, sir.
I am curious to hear your thoughts on not only the state of public education currently in California and how we can get out of the conundrum that we're in now.
Oh, boy. If I knew that, I'd pay my own filing fee. I have till March 12th, I think. I'd run for governor and probably win. I don't mean to be facetious with you. You reminded me of something, and I always try to answer questions. Something I should have pointed out is part of this abject abdication of which I mentioned. And it's worth my saying because it's relevant. In the 40s, when I graduated in 49, we didn't have tuition. We had incidental fees. They were $27.50 a semester. By the 50s, do some arithmetic. Let's say it went up to $100. 55 years ago, let's make it even, make it easy. 50 years ago, the fees at Berkeley were $100. Now, inflation in the last 50 years has been about 1,000%. Stamps were 4 cents, they're now 44 cents. Gasoline was 30 or 40 cents, it's now $3. The whole litany, about 1,000% inflation. Room and board used to be about $100, $120. And fees were $100. Room and board today is $1,200. That's the market. That's the market. Tuition is $10,000. A 10,000% increase. It's a parent tax, my friend. The legislature wouldn't raise revenue for education. But we, the Board of Regents, do that. And we impose the most progressive income tax in the world on parents who make more than $100,000, because then you don't get any student aid, and you've got three children, and you're paying $30,000 a year out of your $100,000 gross income for tuition, and that doesn't even include room and board. The legislature has done that to us. Now, part of that 20-some-odd percent of discretionary money is higher education. As you know, Bill Honig sponsored, and I forget the number, but it was a proposition in the 90s, to lock 20% to 40% of the general fund into K through 14. So the legislature has to override that with a two-thirds vote, which is going to be very, very difficult. So general education, K through 12 at least, has some insulation. I know people are getting their pink slips because it's required by law. And sometime in March, they have to all be informed. They might get fired in June. I don't think, and this is off the top of my head, and I'm not an expert. I haven't been in Sacramento in a couple of years, other than to go to lunch and dinner once in a while with my friends. They still have them, but you have to buy them. And people don't do that. You don't buy lunch for some Democrat somewhere or some Republican. I covered that. But I believe that basic K through 12 will probably be saved to a great extent. The only solace I can give you is the economy's coming back. My God, your 401ks have gone up. I hope they have. Mine has. And within a couple of years, we'll be back to normalcy. I would hope that some of you here somehow have a few Republican legislator friends and colleagues, and you can say, please, spread the wealth a little bit. Don't raise the sales tax. Just broaden it. Do a few things to raise a little bit of revenue. I can't say any more. I don't have the answer. But I gave you my thoughts. You know, there's an old saw in this game, quit when you're ahead. Thanks very much, my friends, unless there are more questions. Nixon used to say, 4 more years. Thanks for caring. Thanks for caring. Do buy a book. The university gets the first.
Thank you, Bill. And with that, I would like to officially close this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened public discussion. Thank you, Bill.
You are welcome.
Don't forget, I'm going to send you that.
Yes.